Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hey, who's there?
It's Melody.
Hey, Melody. You going to join the call today?
I am. As long as I can keep doing it at work.
Did you post a question?
I did.
Interesting. It's weird. Okay. Getting close. Getting close. Well, more questions than I thought there was going to be. Okay. So we got Melody online. Who else is online?
Samuel's out here.
Hey, baby, what's happening?
Just living the dream.
Right.
Yourself? You living that same dream?
Just living the dream, man.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure I'm not alone.
So, and we've also got MIP144.
That's me.
Melody?
Yeah.
Okay, then we've got one more South Texas person.
That might be me. I was kind of having trouble with my computer, so I finally got on the phone. I thought I'd signed off on the computer.
Okay, well, that'll explain everything. I mean, I know that everybody's probably shocked that I'm here on time. We're probably not expecting anything. Wow. Okay. Let's start with the first one. Encouraging my spouse without scaring him. You guys, since we're small today, if you have anything you want to add, jump in there. After months and months of waiting and praying, I've finally seen a few promising signs that my husband might finally be getting it. At counseling the other day, I brought up the fact that my husband doesn't ask my forgiveness and that he hasn't asked the Lord's forgiveness. He says he's going straight to hell and that he deserves it. Our counselor very quickly spoke with him about how God's forgiveness is here for all of us, even though none of us deserves it. All we have to do is ask for it. My husband broke down in tears, which is a huge thing for him. I very quietly picked up our 14-month-old, sat beside him, and held his hand, saying nothing. After the session, we went to lunch, and I asked if he wanted to talk about anything. He said, "No, not right now," because it was very humiliating for him. Since then, I've tried to be there for him, but haven't broached the subject really, as I don't want him to feel hounded or smothered. He really seemed to want me to sit and cuddle with him, but no talking. I just felt a kind of emotional wall between us. My question is, how do I encourage him to continue down his path, to not run and hide from this without him feeling attacked or hounded? You know, the one thing you did was ask him a question. I think that if you can always start with, "Would you mind if we talk about this?" and ask their permission to begin to talk, typically that's a very gentle way to go in, and people will be far more receptive to what you might have to say. You might also ask him if he would be willing to maybe do a book with you, or ask your counselor if maybe if you'd be willing to do a book the two of you could read out loud to each other on forgiveness. There are several really good books on forgiveness. Forgiving the Unforgivable is a good one by Stoops. Also, it used to be called Forgive and Forget by Smeeds. But Smeeds' book on forgiveness, does anybody remember the name of Smeeds' book? Can you, those of you online? Okay, I guess not. But that's another really good book on forgiveness that I highly recommend. So those things, I think, can be really helpful. If you can do a book study together, I think that's huge. And if, you know, if he wants to even know, if he can watch that video that we had posted on the 911, that's the other thing I can think of, where we talked about using the HURT acronym, where you list out the, you let the other person know, just it's a way of making amends. And obviously, if they do something like Harboring Hope, or if he does like the 911 course, we spend a lot of time talking about forgiveness. So those would be just some immediate thoughts on that. And maybe the counselor can work with them on that. Because the problem is, someone like your husband, Shelby, is going to be very shame-based. And if someone's dealing with a lot of shame, you can't hardly broach the subject because they just go into a shame cycle. It's almost like it makes it really difficult for you to heal because they can't heal. And until they understand grace, it's hard to let go of the shame. Or they understand mercy, it's really hard to let go of the shame. And so, as I say, you know, you're always going to get defensive at your point of shame. So you've got to be able to accept forgiveness so that you can help others out. Let's see. Next question. Anybody want to say anything about that? Samuel, you want to add anything there?
You know, I think the suggestion for the book study would be great. I mean, I swear by that, man. We did Emerson and Edgerick's Love and Respect. It changed our marriage. It was fantastic. It was one of the most productive things that we did. Second of all, from talking with Shelby online several times, she's been very forthcoming just with her struggles to try and get her husband to respond. And I think that moment that she's describing is a huge moment that I echo everything that you're saying, obviously, but I think that was such a huge moment. I think it would be great to revel in that moment and to maybe there is, as you say, to kind of use some different methods, but I think that's such a huge moment knowing what I know about the past. I think the more that she can encourage that, compliment it, accept it, reward it, accent, I think that would be tremendous. That's kind of all I would say.
Good. Okay, so Wendy, you're on here. Wendy, how you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
You're muted. Good, I'm glad. Okay, here's your question. I guess the thing that I have the most trouble with at the moment is in our sexual relationship. I'm the HURT partner. My husband and I have been together over 35 years. I have been in love with him from the very beginning. I did not have an idealized view of him. I just loved him and actively in love with him, which takes work over the years, but I thought it was worth it. So much of a sexual life goes on in the brain. People keep talking about how visual men are and how they fantasize. I am very visual, but all of my visual attraction was directed toward my husband. If I had erotic dreams, they would be about him. Nothing out of the ordinary, just normal sex life. He would leave in the morning and I would roll over to his pillow just so I could have his warmth and scent when he was gone. Just looking at his hands was a turn on for me. I had a very rich, sensual appreciation for him. Then the discovery 2+ years ago and the final disclosure 4 months ago about a sexual addiction. I've had a very hard time. John and Leslie and you frequently talk about how none of this is personal. I beg to differ. I can think of nothing more personal than spending 36 years with someone and consistently making choices on a daily basis to turn your back on the person you are married to choose someone else, and in the case of sexual addiction, to choose anybody else every time, not choosing your spouse. Well, I don't know anything any more personal than that. I understand about addiction. We both have 20 years in NA, and I also understand in my active addiction, I make choices. They were my choices to use, granted, that once in that mode, it was about using even when I don't want to. How am I ever supposed to get over the fact that my husband never loved me until now? That the sex life I treasured meant nothing to him, but now he wants to mean something. As I said, so much of sex is in the brain, and what I had has been smashed. Now he wants the passion that I felt for him back. I want it back too, but I can tell you it's a very rough road right now. And at this point, sex is just a matter of physical sensation and friction, with me trying to keep my brain from the images that my husband brought to me instead of the vision of sensual love that I had before. It's very personal. My husband knows that I'm writing you. It's no secret to him. We're signed up for 911. Okay, Wendy, two things. I don't know that if I've ever said it's not personal. I think what I've said is, and you may disagree with this, but it's you're not the problem. It's not about you. This is baggage. He didn't do this because of you. This is baggage he brought into the relationship. So in a sense, as with all addiction stuff, since you've been in NA, you can understand this, it's not that there aren't problems in a relationship potentially, but the way that person chooses to deal with problems is very warped. And so they choose to act out instead of knowing how to live life, as you know, this on life's terms. I'm sorry, what, Wendy?
I said understood. I understand that part.
Yeah, so I just say he would have done this, and when I say it's not personal, I believe he would have done the same thing if he was married to anybody else. It didn't make any difference who his wife is. I mean, this is just a deeper problem. In fact, what's sad about it is he had an amazing wife, and even that wasn't enough to stop him. At the same time, the other piece, Wendy, that I would tell you is that you're doing a little bit of black and white thinking, and from my perspective, when you say that the sex life that the two of you had meant nothing to him, and I can just tell you in my sexual addiction as I came out of that, it wasn't that what I had with Stephanie didn't mean anything to me. As Leslie puts it, I had two sets of books going all the time, and that was the problem.
Well, but, no, he has told me that it didn't mean anything to him.
Okay, well then.
I mean, that's part of our, you know, when we were doing our timeline and our relationship and getting down to what reality was. You know, this is not something that I've come up with. This is something that he has told me.
So basically, he was just using you as a vessel of masturbation.
Essentially, yeah, I guess so.
I'm not trying to be crass. I just think that sometimes that's
No,
just...
I know, yeah.
And so, because he didn't, is it because he didn't really know anything else, do you think?
Part of it was that he had been in a relationship with somebody before me that he'd been dumped, and I didn't know anything about this when we got married. And, you know, I think part of it, he said, has been, you know, that our relationship was payback. You know, he was going to be in a relationship where, you know, he called the shots and, the, you know. But the sexual addiction part was, you know, there from when he was, you know, a kid. Just blossoming over time. But there's several things at play there, you know.
I think the part that that is really relevant in all of this, I mean, all of it's relevant, but at the last part, when you just say, find that one little piece. As I said, so much of sex is in the brain, and what I had has been smashed, and now he wants the passion that I felt for him back. That is the biggest hurdle, I think, because when we develop things that we really appreciate about our mate and the things that make us feel lucky and fortunate to get to be with them, the problem with the infidelity is frequently it destroys those items, like what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, kind of in our own mind, the reasons or the things that, again, made us feel fortunate are gone. And in fact, they can even be negatives now. And so for that to be reestablished, I think two things have to happen. You're telling me you're about 4 months out.
Initial was 2 years ago, but the final was 4 months ago.
Yeah, well, you can start the clock from 4 months ago. I mean, in fact, if the initial's 2 years ago and the final's 4 months ago, in some ways, Wendy, that makes it even harder because it means that every time you think you know, you just find out that you don't.
Yeah.
And so it makes reestablishing trust far more difficult.
Well,
so,
the thing about the final thing was that gives me a little, you know, positive look at it is about the sexual addiction. You know, I mean, he knew he was involved in the behavior. He just didn't understand what that meant until, you know, time had gone by and we'd been reading. And so he told me about that once he realized it. So,
okay, good.
You know, that makes it a little better, even though the information was devastating. At least it was one of the things he had been hiding the behavior, yes. But as soon as he understood what the behavior was, he told me, you know, what it was. So that helped.
How bad is your pain still, Wendy?
Well, I'm getting better. Part of the problem is that right before discovery, we had a rough patch. I won't go into the whole story. But, you know, he made me feel like everything that was wrong in our relationship was my fault. And I had kind of I was having panic attacks and stuff. So I went to counseling. You know, I started, you know, doing what I'd done when I first got into recovery in NA, working on myself really hard. And it got to the point where, okay, this relationship is going to be over, you know, it's all my fault. It's all my fault, everything's gone wrong, and it's going to be over, and I just need to move forward from here. And I was in great shape, you know, my self-esteem was high, my relationship with God was fantastic, I was, you know, loaded for bear, let's put it that way. And then I found, the day before, actually in a meeting, I said, you know, I don't really have any reason, you know, an external reason for this, but my life is the best that it's ever been. You know, I'm just so happy with where I am. And the next day was when I discovered. So it's been really hard for me to crawl up out of the hole because it made me doubt. People go through this all the time, but because I had been on such a such a positive place internally, it made it twice as bad when it happened, and it's been really hard for me to crawl up out of that hole because, you know, these are recovery principles of, you know, working on yourself, getting better. Doesn't matter what the other person's doing. I know I need to do what I need to do for me. And, you know, I know all these things. I'm, you know, somebody telling me that, you know, I told my mentor, you're preaching to the choir. I understood that. I used that with my sponsees. And it makes me even doubt that, you know, because I'm thinking I did this before and look where I ended up.
Right.
So my pain level is, it's better than it was. And I, you know, I did Harboring Hope. You know, I actively work on, you know, getting better, but it's really difficult. And it,
well,
we
you
did
know, the,
listen. We listened to a CD. It's called Making Love Last, and it's by a man named David Rico. And then he's got a book about how to be an adult in relationships. And we listened to that together, and have read part of that, and that's helped me a lot this last week or so. So
good. I'll tell you, part of it is the things that I think you can do that I would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first off, he needs to, as he works his recovery, you'll find that at a heart level, when you see him taking responsibility, that helps you.
Yeah.
Because it when you begin to see things that you can admire and respect in him again,
mm-hmm.
And appreciate about him, but especially admire and respect, where you see him growing, that actually will make him more attractive to you. The second thing is you're going to have trouble as long as you, I mean, the pain will subside over time, and I'm sorry you've got to carry the pain. But until the pain is gone, it's going to be really hard, I think, you'll find for that thing in your brain to work
mm-hmm.
in the same way, because there's just a part of you that almost has a reflex response that is kind of scared to get close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up fighting internally against yourself.
Right.
And that will go away over time. Usually, you know, it'll be probably several more months. But the other thing you might want to try that may help, I don't know, and maybe y'all do this already, I can't remember if I've ever talked about this, but using eyes open sex,
sometimes
just increases the amount of sense of connection where you know that they're really present with you. And if you really, I really believe the eyes are the windows to the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can begin to see their heart for you again, I think that sometimes that really helps. So, you know, the best I know to do is tell you that it's probably going to be a little bit of time.
Oh, goody, something more that takes time.
Well, but hopefully not too much. Try finding those things. Again, just try finding those other pieces. I mean, in terms of looking at what he's doing that you could admire, just try to focus on those.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of doing what you're talking about, the book. I think that type of thing is also very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like establishing almost a new way of looking at it. Anytime you can find a new way of looking at your sexuality, it opens up new pathways for you to find that attraction again.
Yeah.
And remember, and I think you're probably not doing this, Wendy, but what you want to do is make your goal even more than maybe just trying to be visually attracted to him, just becoming all the woman that God's made you to be. I mean, your own pursuit of your own sexuality and your own healing. Sometimes even focusing it a little bit more towards yourself in terms of, you know, how expressive can I be just in terms of a woman or a man?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that'll help too. Hope that helps a little.
Okay.
I wish I had a better answer.
Everything always comes down to time, doesn't it?
Well, when it comes to healing your heart, it does a little bit. There's just not a shortcut.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next question, how do I get my husband, the unfaithful spouse, to talk? Lots of luck. Let's see. My question for you is, why does my husband refuse to talk to me? His apology to me after getting caught in his affair has to this day been very general, nothing specific, just I'm sorry. Okay, what more do you want from me? When I try to talk about what was happening in our lives that brought us to his infidelity, he clams up and won't talk, just listens until I feel exhausted and frustrated. He stops seeing the affair partner and doesn't hang around with his old drinking crowd. My husband's a good man who got caught in behaviors of unsafe friends and the flattery of a needy divorced woman. He refuses to verbalize what he's done to me, to himself, to our three grown children. He says he's showing me he has changed by his actions, which I've told him means everything to me, but that he just wants to put it all behind us now, and it's up to me to get over it so we can move on. He refuses to go to the counseling, and I am submissive to him and have only asked that we pray and have devotional time once a week, which he stopped doing about 5 months ago. Revelation was last fall. Thank you for your consideration. The subscription to your site has been very healing for me. Back to the biggest issue that I typically run across with men and women who have been unfaithful is their shame. And anytime someone is shame-based, their ability to be considerate or to consider what's happening to other people is almost non-existent. There's got to be an element of self-acceptance and self-forgiveness. Just being able to accept forgiveness if they're going to be able to talk about it. And the problem gets to be, Deb, anytime you bring up this whole issue because of his shame cycle, because he hasn't been able to shift the way he looks at it, he immediately goes into self-condemnation, which causes him to shut down. And I'm not saying it's an excuse. It's not. And he's probably, the shame leaves the relationship. He does. He just wants you to be able to move on so he doesn't have to feel the pain. Which is self-centered in and of itself, which is what the shame does, is makes people self-centered. Anything you can do, if he would even be willing to read something, the little article I had with Will, I think we talk about that some, the article on how do you regain trust, if he's willing to do some of those things to help you, other resources out there, that's good. The other way you might talk to him about is see if he can even recognize the shame himself, and you might do that by just asking, do you feel shame about what's happened? When we were talking about the initial one about encouraging my spouse without scare, was that one or yeah, on forgiveness? Reading a book with him, too, if he would do it, just on forgiveness. Make it about something outside of infidelity, or make it about something like love and respect, or anything that kind of just opens up dialogue might help him in terms of being able to work his mind around what's happening. The very fact that he got caught up with the flattery of a needy divorced woman still talks about his need for image and his need for being kind of pumped up, per se. And I feel bad for him because, the only way he's going to get free is when he can get to the place where he can let go of the shame, because that stuff ultimately is just going to drive him crazy. So I do wish that, maybe he'll do something in the future. If he would even do something like the online course, that would be something that might work for him too, but that may be way too close to home because even going there is going to kick off shame. But it would certainly be a way for him to get beyond the shame. As I see it, that is probably one of the biggest barriers, and so it may be really difficult to get him to shift. But I can tell you that I'll be praying for you. Okay, reinforcing my decision. Well, after a year since discovery and no let up in my wife's affair, I've drawn a line in the sand. Way to go! Congratulations. After proving she spent the past 2 weekends with her fair partner and not her friend, as she told our children, I told her the kids and I were going camping this weekend, and when we returned Sunday night, she was to be out of the house. I've reinforced this several times this week by reminding her that she is the one who wanted out, and she has until Sunday to go. I believe I'm doing this in a manner that is not vengeful or mean, but cannot call it loving either. As I leave for camping, I'm thinking of placing her luggage next to the dresser to hammer home the message that her behavior is unacceptable and she has to move out. My question is, would be putting her luggage in the room show I'm serious or that I'm being spiteful? And my opinion is it would just show you're totally serious. I don't think, in fact, I would even put some reminder notes of things she may want to pick up and take with her. Say, don't forget to take your this and don't forget to take that, just to help her out a little bit. No, the luggage is not being spiteful, but the luggage is giving a very clear message to her. Now, my question, though, is going to be, what are you going to do when you come back and she hadn't left? Because there's a strong probability she's going to stay. So, you know, then what do you do at that point? And now that you've drawn the line in the sand, to me, you really don't have any other option but to go ahead and file, only because if you don't follow through from here, then there's going to be you're just going to lose respect. So I think put the luggage out there, and we'll all pray that she packs up and moves out. If not, you'll have to file and then take it from that direction, but you don't back up from where you're at. Now, you may wonder, what if she says, I don't want to get divorced? If she were to say that, I would suggest that you say, I am so glad to hear that. I think that, you know, maybe after 3 or 4 months or 6 months of the separation, we can look at where we're at to see if you still want that. But even now, I wouldn't back up on the separation. Just because she says she doesn't want the divorce would in no way mean that she's ready to work on the relationship or that she's ready to address the issue in her. I would just strongly recommend don't back up now that you've gotten to this place. Instead, protect yourself and protect your children. And then hopefully, you know, she'll come to her own senses. And over time, with time, you'll be able to see, you know, that change in what she's doing in her life. It may take a while. It was funny. I actually was treating a case just this past year. They actually came to an EMS weekend in the fall, and they got remarried in May, and it was the same sort of thing. She couldn't let go of her affair partner, and eventually they got divorced. And when she came to her senses, it was a really neat story. They certainly didn't even, neither of them really felt like it was important to move back. In fact, the way that he knew that she was really serious and broken wasn't that she was asking to move home. She was saying she didn't deserve to get to move home. She just said that, you know, she was hoping that at least he would spend some time with her to see if her heart had changed, and she would do it however, whatever worked best for him. So she wasn't demanding anything from him in terms of what the conditions would be. She was just simply asking very politely. With your mate, I'd suggest the same thing. I mean, if she's in there kind of telling you how to callate the cabbage, at this point, I would just say that she's still not broken. And until you see a really softness of heart where she's willing to do whatever it takes to make this thing work, I would just be very leery of her, and I would give her a wide berth, and I'd keep moving toward the separation. So, next question, unless anybody has any comments on that one. Physical affairs. Okay, my husband's behavior makes me believe he's had physical affairs throughout our marriage, though he denies it. However, he's denied many things such as financial deceit, pornography, spousification with our daughter, all of which have been revealed. My pain of his betrayal and abandonment is deep. He continues to lie to me and to others and God, and God has revealed more of his lies recently. I was in the last release of Harboring Hope, and it was very helpful. However, due to the lack of admission of evidence of an affair, I don't seem to fit into what is talked about with ARC on the forums. Yet, I understand that ARC states that infidelity is the keeping of secrets, which is my husband's, has a bunch of gold medals in. Can you please address infidelity and betrayal without the admission of a physical affair? And, yes, infidelity is, as I look at it, is very much that keeping of secrets. The problem with, I think, what you're talking about is the secretiveness and the lies within a relationship create the same dynamic for the hurt spouse of whether it's a physical affair, whether it's a friendship. It still creates that attachment distress because that oneness is broken. And unless the other person is showing a willingness to really be safe in the future, a willingness to help heal the wound that they've created, then I guess the prognosis would be the word I'm thinking of. The prognosis for the relationship is very poor because you can't heal. Again, whether it's a physical affair or not, there's got to be the willingness to address it. And it just because if he's not there, I think, stating to you over and over again that making amends for what he's done, if everything is still aimed at you in terms of I'm only doing this or it's blaming you, if there's still an element of denial, then it's, you know, I don't know how you go forward very well from there unless you're just feeling called of God. You accept who he is and what he is, and you just feel called that that's where you're supposed to be because he's not going to be there to help you heal. And I think as long as the secrets are there, you know, there's no way to ultimately feel safe in the relationship, and without safety in the relationship, again, it's almost impossible to go forward. I think you, as always, you give it a season, a period of time to determine what's happening in the relationship and whether or not they're going forward. And if over time you don't see that change and a softening of heart and a coming back and a willingness for things to be different, I think for your own sanity's sake, you probably have to pull away. I know that probably is a terrible answer. I feel like I'm just kind of floating out here. But you know, you once that time period's up, you do have to come to a place to make a decision. So lots of luck. That's an incredibly difficult situation. Let's see. Next question. Arguments, fights, post-disclosure. Rick, ever since disclosure of the affair happened 2.5 months ago, it seems that any time we have the slightest argument, it seems to turn into something much larger than it probably should. Obviously, both of us are on emotional pins and needles, and I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But it seems like for me, when we fight, and I'm the hurt spouse, that the sadness and hurt seem to multiply exponentially. And for her, it seems that the anger and guilt seem to multiply exponentially. Those two things will frequently cause things to spin seemingly out of control in a hurry, even when the argument from the outside seems like it should be smaller. Admittedly, when we're having these sorts of fights, I will tend to want to keep talking to work through it, and my spouse will tend to want to take a time out and think about it for a while before coming back to discuss. I'm sure my spouse is probably more correct on this than I am on that subject. When we take time outs, I tend to dwell and start to feel worse than I to feel worse than if I were voicing my opinion. My question for you is, what are the best ways to act and curb these massive arguments and to keep them at a more manageable level? In many of the things you've written and videos that you've posted, it's clear that the feelings of one step up and two or tens step back is not uncommon when, the stepping up and stepping back is not uncommon when having one of these fights. But I'd love to make more of one step up and one step back, if at all possible. Thanks for all you're doing and your insights you might have to share. This is probably one of my favorite topics, actually. I think that we're going right back to attachment distress. And one of the things I was talking about earlier in the call today, which is frequently the hurt spouse or the unfaithful spouse will feel a great deal of shame. I've got 5 different angles I can take this one. Most couples, I'll start, when they fight, it's because they're both right. Rarely do I see couples fight because one of them is wrong. So I call them right fights. One person's fighting from the perspective of, you know, what you did has really hurt me, and the other person's fighting from the perspective of intent or motive, such as that's not what I meant, it wasn't about you or whatever. But when you have one person talking about the behavior and the impact of a behavior and another person talking about a motive or an intention, those are two totally separate topics. And so that you're unable to even hear each other. That's the first point. Second, there are very different – people have very different styles of communicating frequently. And you're someone that I call an above-ground processor. In other words, it helps you to be able to speak and talk through what's going on. That's how you modulate your anxiety. As long as you can talk – and continue being connected with the person working through it, you feel hope and you move forward. But frequently, we're married to somebody who is the opposite. They're an underground processor. Underground processors, the way they self-soothe is they stonewall, and they get very quiet, and they want to go inside and process before they end up talking about it. if you've got somebody who's an above-ground processor and an underground processor, you end up almost like what I call a turtle and a shark. You know, the turtle is withdrawing in the shell, trying to calm down and figure out what to do, and the shark's on the outside hitting the shell going, come out, come out, come out, like that, you know. So you both have to figure out how do we manage our different styles of relating in information. You're going to probably have to find a way to calm down besides having to talk, and she's going to have to be able to figure out how to calm down sometimes when she is talking. To keep it from becoming massive fights, one of the first things I recommend to couples is always, always, always wear a pulse watch when you're at home. For both of you, when you kick into the amygdala, you go into fight or flight. Your sympathetic nervous system will kick off any time either of you gets triggered. Once your pulse rate jumps over 100 beats a minute, neither of you has the ability to have a constructive discussion at that point. And so I always say let the watch end up being the mediator in the situation. Because if y'all have to agree to like a 10 or 15 minute timeout every time somebody's watch pops 100, then you can both know that nothing constructive could be happening if you continue talking. And you know, as somebody who's an above ground processor, that it's not going to be very long so you get a chance to keep voicing your opinion so that you can kind of work things through in your head so that you can also relax. Just like I said earlier, your wife also needs to be able to work through her shame so that speaking with you doesn't trigger her so badly in her own shame cycle, which will ultimately begin to shut things back down. Finally, in the aftercare group that we do, both with EMS and 911 Marriage, we cover different styles of communication, and what you're describing is actually a find a bad guy dance. And the way that couples, the dance of love is very much a dance of hearts, where you don't really talk about your opinions on issues, but if you want to get down to the deeper waters, you've got to begin to state how things are making you feel, not what you think, but how you feel, because we may disagree on our opinions of what something is. But my feelings are my feelings. Nobody can tell me that they're illegitimate. So I'll just read a list of feelings I have people use all the time when they're trying to communicate. These are softer emotions. When people are getting angry, I make them use this feeling sheet. And it says, you know, I'm feeling lonely. And you just pick out the feelings that work for you. Lonely or dismissed, not important, frustrated and helpless, on guard, uncomfortable, scared, hurt, hopeless, helpless, intimidated, threatened, panicked, rejected, like I don't matter, ignored, inadequate, shut out, and alone, confused and lost, embarrassed, ashamed, blank, afraid, shocked, sad, forlorn, disappointed, isolated, let down, numb, humiliated, overwhelmed, small or insignificant, unwanted, vulnerable, and worried. And if you'll even copy those down, I think what you would find over time, that ability to use those words really goes a long way in it just goes a long way in helping you to get to those softer emotions, which you can respond to someone feeling, I think, panicked and rejected. You're going to have a very different discussion if you go with that sort of conversation than just kind of arguing over a point. Okay, so here's another one. Last but not least. Rick, can you please explain the difference between when the unfaithful spouse wants to do pretend normal rather than facing and dealing with the carnage they've dropped on the betrayed spouse. My husband says, look, I pay the bills, keep roof over your head, come home every night. You have access to my bank account, cell phone, bills, email account. What more do you want from me? He's finally started talking with a mentor, but he's made it crystal clear to me that he only wants to talk to this guy and is not interested in anything else on this stupid site. I don't know how to explain it, but even when he seems to be doing some of the right stuff, somehow he manages to make it all about himself. He acts as if he really believes he's the biggest victim here, and this is all just way too hard for him. I would love to think that I mean so much to him that he feels so deeply remorseful over what he's done that he's willing to do anything it takes to make things right and to help me heal and our marriage to heal. This is so not the case. It feels like he's only going to do just enough to get me off his back and nothing more. Every time I start to think he's actually getting real, and so I start to relax and begin to think that we actually might survive this with our marriage still intact and be even more in love with each other than ever, the mask comes off again, and I see that we're still in the same place. I'm so tired. It doesn't even hurt as much as it used to. Right now, leaving him and having my life of my own would be a blessed relief and peace. Please tell me what it would look and feel like if he were getting it, and we were actually on the right track to healing rather than running his stupid hamster wheel forever, getting nowhere at all. I can't do this anymore. Just right now, I want out. I can understand why you would. You know, it's funny, this is kind of the theme of today's call, but it still goes back to the shame core, not as an excuse. I can just, as you look at it, anytime somebody feels has a victim status, and this is always, I think it's always true. Anytime someone's a big victim, it means that they have resentments. They have not released their resentments. And until they release the resentments they're holding, it's really hard for them to, it's hard for them to reengage. So at one level, there's something I would suspect that he's still holding against you, but because of what he's done, it's difficult for him to be necessarily honest with you about his struggles. As I said earlier in this call, sometimes people end up, a lot of times affairs are really that person's inability to deal with other circumstances that are in the relationship. And instead of dealing straight up with those issues, what they do is they start acting out sexually in an affair. In the case, the type of thing you're describing, that's frequently the point. He needs a way to maybe deal with some of his resentments, but the problem with the infidelity is it's hard to begin to explore maybe some of the issues in the relationship that were really bothering him to begin with. And hopefully, and I understand you're discouraged, because I mean, it'd be really discouraging. But until he gets rid of his shame and he can get honest about how to appropriately address those issues, it's going to be really hard. I would hope and pray, you know, if you ask him potentially about what some of his, what he's resentful about in the relationship, that may be one way to get him to begin to talk to you about it. That's one way to go at it. Another thing that is possible, since he's not going to do anything else on the dumb site, There is a life coach that I use that does a lot of work. He's a recovery coach. His name is Bill Thurston. He's in Salt Lake, but he does everything long distance. And let me give you Bill's telephone number, too. It's 801-520-3665. That's 801-520-3665. And a lot of times when I have someone that's having trouble getting it, that really is still in pretend normal, I'll refer them to Bill and let Bill just kind of do his coaching thing from Utah. Because he has a really good way, especially with men, of kind of relating to them and helping them get it. I mean, I'm not, certainly not saying that if he's using a mentor, we're probably in pretty good shape. But the difference is they can talk directly to Bill, and sometimes it, for a guy, it may speed him up a bit. I hope that basically answered the question. I want to thank everybody for joining the call today. And I'll be praying for all of you. I know it's tough situations, and but hang in there. We'll be starting 911 for those of you who are taking that next week, so I'm really looking forward to that, guys. And I'll talk to you all next Thursday. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rick.